How you doing? I'm always tempted to begin these with a sort of homily, like a Presbyterian minister at 10 to 12 at night. I'm so old, I can remember when the last thing that used to happen on television before the service stopped was that a member of the clergy would appear and do a little piece to camera. Apparently, often in a studio with nothing there but a pedal to begin the process, so he would watch, almost invariably was a he would watch the timer and then press the foot pedal, and then he had the control of the air for 5 minutes with nobody else in the production crew available. It's a good job they didn't let me do that. But this led to a character, Ricky Fulton, the comedian, produced a character called the Reverend I.M. Jolly, and there would be a spoof every New Year's Eve or Hogmanay when the Reverend I.M. Jolly would speak to the nation and begin by saying something like, "I hope you're having a good time. I've had a hell of a week." So there's something about these podcasts that makes me want to revert to the character of Reverend I.M. Jolly, because every human being loves to have a good moan, and as soon as you think you've got any audience at all, then misery loves company. So I thought I'd say something on a personal note. I'm running for election at the moment, trying to become a councillor in Glasgow, because I don't think Glasgow's particularly well administered, and that's putting it mildly. But at the moment it's snowing. We've got snow on the ground, and we're still a couple of months from the election, so I don't think there's much to be gained from me going out and troubling people on a day like this. So I thought I'd trouble you instead. I've not been really making much of an effort to try and write anything or do any podcasts, because I've been standing at doorsteps trying to convince people that the constitutional question as to whether the United Kingdom should be separated into two states is rather less relevant than getting the bins emptied and the roads fixed. You'd be surprised how many people are resistant to that proposition. Then again, you might be surprised by how many are actually convinced that it's high time somebody said something. But be that as it may, I also have been conducting litigation. I don't know how many of you have ever thought that somebody richly deserves to come unstuck when they've behaved badly. Someone says or does something and you think, "I'd love to take that look off your face." So in 2017, somebody who was very full of themselves said something inappropriate about me on the web in a comment section of a newspaper. And I asked them and asked them and asked them and asked them repeatedly to simply modify or delete their comments, but they dug their heels in and decided they weren't gonna, because everyone, of course, on the internet, when they threaten you with legal action, are just bluffing. They won't go through with it. The trouble is that not everybody's bluffing, so I unsuccessfully sued their employer to hold them accountable for their behaviour, which I dare say didn't do them much good at work. And then when that ended, I then sued them as an individual, just when they thought it was all over. So it took 5 years, but at the end of it, I think I taught them a lesson. It wound up finally 2 days ago when they'd incurred a whole load of legal costs, and then right before the hearing asked whether we could just stop the whole thing and they would pay their own costs. And with some soul searching, I decided that that was an actual fact enough. And that was a nil-nil draw under difficult circumstances. Now, as I say, the reason why this is worth mentioning is that it's quite important when you're young to recognise that just because something's unlikely doesn't mean it's impossible. When I was younger, the number of risks I took, the number of things I did that were ridiculously ill-advised, but when you're young, you don't take advice very well. The Scottish independence movement is characterised by slogans. I stood on the doorstep of a MSP, a member of the Scottish Parliament. His partner came to the door last week, and we're talking and obviously not agreeing. But I decided, I said to her, I said, "Just watch this for a second." So I went in the character and did the piece to the voter that any Scottish nationalist would do. Are we the only country that can't be independent? What about Denmark? What about Norway? What about the oil fund? It's as much our currency as theirs. A modern progressive vision, a country at peace with itself, you know. So I did the whole thing, And she looked shocked. She looked undone. And the reason why she was shocked was because she couldn't actually believe that anyone could understand that spiel and not be convinced of the cause, because she thought that that was what thought was. She thought that was the level of generality that the issue actually amounted should be conducted at. That's what it amounted to. And when you're young, you don't really understand that there's another world of ideas available that you'll acquire as you're older, if you're lucky. You don't understand just how limited your understanding is. You've no awareness of it. This is almost Donald Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns. You can't begin to imagine what it'll be like to be older. And I was the same when I was younger. Maybe every generation has to repeat the same mistakes. Certainly, looking at Scotland today, it's as if Plato's predictions in the Republic were entirely accurate and nothing has changed in 2,500 years. But as I say, this individual that I sued was full of confidence and full of aggression, but it was all a kind of fragile aggression caused by the desire to not lose face in public. He didn't want to modify his comments or delete them. And what he did was he consigned himself to 5 years of anxiety and upset and finally considerable expense, all of which could have been avoided. Now, I gave in, if you like, 2 days ago. In other words, I let him walk away with just a legal bill to pay. And didn't go to the hearing, which would have taken place on Monday morning. And arguably that's because I've spent 5 years learning a bitter lesson as well, learning what I knew to be true about education, but I hadn't fully appreciated was true of the courts. Although I suspected it, because 20 years ago I had a similar experience in court when I saw just how bad as thinkers, frankly, a lot of the judges were. But I was in correspondence with the other side's lawyer. And he said, "I've seen your argument, I've read it, it won't wash, it won't pass muster. These are the cases," and so on. Now, this chap was very, very well regarded solicitor of enormous experience. But speaking to somebody who's published academic articles in philosophy, his reasoning was poor. I won't bore you with the details because there are a few things more boring than somebody else's legal cases, saved somebody else's dreams, maybe. But he was saying things which would be really easy to puncture. You claim that this matter is straightforward, and you claim that in 1997 you did this. The trouble is, if you think carefully, that can't then be true, because if that were true, then it would have been the case in 1906, and this other case that you rely on, that this would all have been decided. So you're contradicting yourself. The things you're saying don't make any sense. And it would be easy to do that. But the trouble is that think how bored you were those last 20 seconds when I said that. Think how utterly alienated you are. You may well have stopped listening to the podcast. So when people talk about how a political system runs, or how an electoral system runs, or how the court system runs, or what it's actually like to be at the chalk face in education, or what the difficulties of police officers are as they go about their business, nobody's really interested enough. They don't believe that taking an interest would pay them enough, would be enough in the way of a reward to make it worthwhile. Because the only thing a citizen has to do is vote every 4 or 5 years. And listening to somebody talk about a failing system when there's millions voting and little will be done to change the system anyway, why would you bother? Nothing, there's nothing that you could possibly gain that would make it worth the sacrifice. And this is why, of course, societies start to go wrong. When you hit the age of 56 or 57, you begin to realize just how tectonic everything is, just how fundamental the forces are, and just how little can be done. And as I say, it might well be the case that Plato was right 2,500 years ago. On much he plainly was right. Much that he said, the famous remark, the whole of philosophy is footnotes to Plato. Much that he said plainly was right. And it's only when you get a reasonable age, when you get some experience behind you begin to realize just how inertial everything is and just what a small part reason has to play in the world. You can say something which is penetrating and destructive, but most people won't hear it. They won't actually understand what's been said. Even today, for example, the Scottish independence debate is continuing with things being said about pensions and currencies and similar things. And the vast majority of people, having spent 6 or 7 weeks knocking on doors, the vast majority of people can't really understand. And if at the end of a 5 minute conversation they seem to understand better than when you arrived at the door, you really have to wonder how they live their lives. I said something on the web, and I'll repeat it in this podcast, so that if the Daily Record's journalists want to sabotage me before the May election, they can do so. Because I think the truth matters, and it doesn't matter whether idiots. There's a famous line in If by Kipling: if you can stand to see the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools. So I'd like to construct a trap so that knaves can make a trap for fools, because I'd rather go down fighting for something that's true than become a complete liar like a lot of other people. So the simple fact is, and it's a hard thing to say, but it's a true thing to say, there's an alarming correlation between the value of a house, particularly if it's occupied by older people. You sometimes get a big house, an expensive house, that's got a younger person in it. They may have inherited it, or they may not be the owner. But if you've got a big house and it's owned, or the people coming to the door are older folk, then almost certainly, even if they're busy, even if they're working, they'll give you a few seconds of their time or a couple of minutes. And they might even tell you that they've only got a couple of minutes. But they'll listen to you, and they'll say things back that make sense. They'll make it obvious that they understand what you're saying when they speak back. And they'll be talking about issues that they've considered before. They'll have a position. If you knock on a door where folk presumably have less money, given how they seem to live and given the house, you'll find that they're keen to shut the door in your face. They're no interested. No, do you notice how I dropped the T there? No interested instead of not interested. That's the kind of habit you pick up when you're canvassing, you're knocking on doors. It's called, it's not vowel shift, it's code shift. You tend to start talking about the people you're talking to in order to try and win them over. And you would think, many people would say, that the reason why folk in difficult circumstances won't listen is because they're used to being harassed for money, people coming to the door and trying to sell them things. Really? You think that's true? If you were trying to sell things, wouldn't you go to the more expensive addresses? Or you would argue that they're hugely inconvenienced, they've got massive responsibilities, and that they're rushing to do things. Not been my experience. Usually the person that's sitting at what looks like a Zoom call coming to your door, and it becomes obvious that they're a solicitor or whatever when they talk to you. Or the person running downstairs from an upper bedroom and says, I'm actually in a work call, what is it? These are the people that are up against it in terms of time and pressure. A lot of the folk they interrupt in less advantaged circumstances are sitting watching a big screen telly when you knock on the door. It may well be true, and I think it is to some degree, and you can argue about the extent to which it's true, that there is nothing more likely to produce success and wealth than being interested and engaged in the world at a level beyond generality and titillation. And there's nothing more likely to produce failure and difficulty and upset and anger and indignation and blaming others than focusing on every thought and every experience that passes through your mind and demanding to be comfortable and demanding to not be upset. If you want to find a door plastered in no leaflets, no canvassers, no religious people, no this, no that, a piece of paper stapled to it or saying I deny access to Scottish and Southern electricity, presumably because I've not paid my electricity bill. If you want to see a door which has just got loads and loads of aggressive, inflammatory, provocative stuff attached to it, don't go to an area where there's £800,000 houses. Go to a less advantaged area. And folk will say that's because folk in difficult circumstances have got a lot to complain about. I wonder if that's true across the board and that's the explanation for everything you see. Or whether in actual fact, if you're bored and uninterested and you like very immediate responses in your body. Ian Banks, in one of his novels, I think Complicity, says that when he's deprecating religion, he's rubbishing all these ideas, or the character is rubbishing these ideas. And he talks about the first time he smokes a cigarette, and here it was, something that could actually change fundamentally the way you felt about the world in seconds. And it was a physical thing right in front of you. I mean, this idea that you can treat yourself as matter, and to, as a play on words, in the long term that won't matter. That might be a very dangerous stance. And as I say, the last week, trying to combine canvassing and campaigning with litigation and court action, and dealing with people across the political legal divide, if you like, being facing two ways for a week. Looking at the law and the courts, the things that are supposed to be most fundamental to society. Donald Finlay said that. You can have a functioning society as long as you've got the rule of law even if it's not democratic. But if you don't have rule of law, you don't have anything. And spending the last, if indeed it's more than a week, but it's particularly intensely the last week, spending time focusing on the law and the courts and process and all that relates to civil obligations, and at the same time facing the public and trying to persuade them about how the city would best run. I don't know if I feel like Aristotle's soldier taking off his hoplite armour in order to go and talk in the assembly, but I begin to understand just what the Greeks were talking about when they described the problems of politics. There's a piece in The Guardian this morning by Gabby Hinsliff on the universal basic income, and she's arguing against it actually, because she says that in order to make it universal, and there's much to be said, she thinks, in favour of universal basic income in terms of solidarity and preventing great privation. But she thinks the trouble is that even if you tax it away, it still results in too small an amount for the truly poor to make much of a difference. And therefore, there's a case to be made for using far more of the total available welfare budget on the hardest to reach, most disadvantaged cases. She's talking in part about a proposal in Wales, I think it's actually happening, a policy of giving care experienced kids quite a high basic income for a number of years, I think £1,600, and an advisor in order to give them the kind of security that kids who can return to the family home have. Because if you're in very difficult circumstances, Roosevelt, FDR, said this, a hungry man won't take a chance. And therefore, you know, there's something to be said for welfare, because it empowers people to take risks that they won't take if they know that they can fall the whole way, if you like. You have to know there's a limit to how far you can fall. Like a soldier knowing that there's medical staff and field clearing stations and pensions and money available for dependents. You know, they're not going to go forward if they know that they can lose absolutely everything on the toss of a coin. So the argument, Hinsliff's argument, is that a welfare payment far in excess of a universal basic income, but not universal, would be much wiser than universal basic income. Now, I don't know whether that's true, and I think that it might actually be problematic for exactly the same reason that a universal basic income is problematic. We don't easily think really deeply about what it is that allows us to do anything in a territory. We don't really think through the consequence of two things being true. One, we've got a world of nation states where the state's writ only runs as far as the borders, and therefore the ability to tax only runs that far as well. Now, the Americans, of course, have worldwide taxation. So if you're an American, unless you renounce your citizenship, and to do that, if you've got more than, I think, $2 million, you have to go through an extended process of allowing Uncle Sam to work out what you owe them before you can get out of your citizenship. So you can't just simply renounce it. But in most countries, a citizen can get out of paying taxes by leaving the territory. And there are double taxation agreements anyway. And also as well, people change their behaviour even if they don't leave the country based on the laws that they face. So in a world of free trade where people and things can move, and in a world where everybody grows up trying to work out how the place operates and therefore what behaviours will be advantaged, in that world, a universal basic income requires a lot of money, or indeed deep welfare, extensive welfare, the kind that Hinsliff is talking about, requires a lot of money. And what you're assuming is that despite the fact that fridges and freezers and televisions and firearms and every other thing that people pay money for can be made all around the world and move without any real imposition of duties and taxes. Most things move without very great imposition of taxes these days and duties. There's global free trade to a degree that surprises most people when they look at it. So if somebody in rural China can make a shotgun and sell it in America or the UK, and a farmer's looking to buy a shotgun to control vermin, And they can buy one for £130 that works perfectly well, or one that's £300 because it works about the same, but it was made by people who have to pay huge taxation in order to make it in the UK. Then probably the Chinese one will sell and the British one will get out of business. So in a world of global free trade, if you impose lots and lots of costs on people, it'll make them uncompetitive for anything that's traded in global markets. If you then add to that changes, behavioural changes. So for example, the Scottish Government this week was boasting about the number of general practitioners that we have in Scotland. But what they don't boast about is the number of full-time equivalent general practitioners we have in Scotland. And that's because for anyone who can make £110,000-£120,000 a year, the Scottish tax system means that you're losing half of it beyond £43,000. So we've got a major problem in that a huge number of medics work on 0.35, 0.4 contracts because it doesn't serve their interest to actually make themselves irritable, exhausted, stressed out, and taking time away from family activities. It doesn't serve their interest to actually persist beyond 0.35, 0.4 of a contract in order to win that little bit of extra money when you're already up against it in terms of stress. Because even being a 0.4 doctor is stressful. So in a world where people change their behaviour based on the rules and where goods move, you're automatically in difficulty when you try and do something expensive. And then there's the third issue. So quite aside from the business of, you know, having to compete against all countries everywhere when it comes to the manufacture of goods, and therefore you'll instantly be in difficulty if you make life difficult for anyone, make life expensive for anyone involved in production in the UK, if you then also allow goods to travel, to move, where they've been produced by those who are not facing the same costs, not facing the same transfer payments. So quite aside from that difficulty, and then the difficulty of people perhaps leaving your country to escape your taxation regime, and then the difficulty caused by people perhaps changing their behaviour, even if they stay in the country, based on your taxation regime. You've then got the third issue, which is the fourth issue, which is people actually changing their behaviour and becoming at the margin more likely to be dependent, changing their behaviour in harmful ways. Because Hinsliff says the security that middle class kids have when they try to become advocates and they go to Edinburgh and they live in a shared flat and they're making no money whatsoever, but they know that they can always retreat back to Perth and the family home if they have to. There'll always be a little bit of money there if they desperately need it. If the flat they're living in becomes noisy and disruptive and there are problems, they can walk away from the £400 deposit if they need to. And there's that safety net. And therefore, this encourages risk-taking behaviour. True. But I personally have taught kids who have got exactly the kind of extensive safety net provided by the state. And it doesn't encourage good behaviour. It encourages the opposite. It can encourage very dangerous behaviour. It can encourage. I had a student who was a care experience kid who was going to therefore be receiving large sums of money until he was, I think, leaving higher education at 24, 25. And his behaviour and the way he spoke to me and the way he dealt with other people had massive elements in it, which would be very problematic if he didn't snap out of it. And one of the things that people miss when they compare the state and a middle class family is that 99 times out of 100, the kid from the middle class family has not only got the home and the little bit of money if they need it, they've got 18 years of socialisation in the family that could afford the home and acquired the money. So when Hinsliff says kids will be in the same position apropos the wider world as they head out into it, because they've got the state behind them in the same way that kids who are upper middle class have got their family behind them. The trouble is the state isn't a family, and the kid is not going to be the product of the state in the same way that the middle class kid is a product of the family. Quite the opposite. The attempt by the state to be a parent will probably have caused the kid exactly the problems that Hinsliff identifies. And the way that the kids who are the products of state care will respond to financial security as they enter into the world, it doesn't seem to me that it's a good, easy supposition to imagine that they'll benefit in the way that, for example, a middle-class kid who has been checked, controlled, encouraged, and in a million and one ways socialised over 18 years, how they'll respond to knowing that there's a safety net. I'll get to the punchline that I've been trying to actually avoid delivering. An awful lot of people say that military service, in active service or national service, changed their lives. If you look back at kids who grew up in great poverty and difficulty and were bodies in motion and disruptive and dangerous, the thing that sorted them out, a lot of older people will say, whether it's true or not, I don't know, it's anecdotal anyway, but a lot of people today will say that they're 18 months or 2 years with someone who began the relationship by screaming at them, you may have broken your mother's heart, but you won't break mine. The number of people who say that it was the army that sorted me out, it was the navy that sorted me out, this was the first time I ever felt part of the pack, but had to know my place. I was fully in the group, but I was fully in my place. And I absolutely would get what King's regulations required me to get, and I would absolutely toe the line with the rest of the unit and clean my boots. That was the first ever experience of something like good parenting, and it wasn't delivered by a parent, and it wasn't delivered by a social worker, and it wasn't even delivered by the state generally. It was delivered by one particular group of people, Crown employees who didn't have to take their nonsense. Megan Nolan is in The Guardian writing about her tattoos. She's plastered in tattoos, and she's agreeing that they're a mistake, or that each of them was a mistake, but that altogether maybe they're not a mistake. She's responding to Melanie Phillips, who's a sort of right-wing commentator, journalist, and appears on, I think, The Moral Maze in Radio 4. But Phillips has expressed quite a lot of opposition and disgust with the normalisation of tattoos, and suggests that they're evidence of a society in difficulty. And Nolan says that while the tattoos she looks back on and recognises that probably they represent mistakes, nevertheless, they also objectify for others life's journey, and also to herself. She says that she no longer hates her body, so she recognises, I think her argument is that she recognises that life's a journey because she sees the evidence of that journey displayed to herself in the mirror, in the tattoos. And therefore, you know, there's no point in regretting the sum of them, because that would be to regret your life. So they represent a kind of visible record to herself and others of the process. Now, I don't have any tattoos. I've thought about having one down the nape of my neck. And that my feeling was I was going to get T124X down the back of my neck, where I couldn't see it but others could, because T124X was the form that the Merchant Navy signed to put themselves under Royal Navy command during the Second World War. My old pal Griff, who died a few years ago, was in the Merchant Navy, and the old devil, as I've said before, wanted to get the money, the danger money, out of the Navy. But his mother wouldn't sign the forms to let him join. But he was on a bus and he heard the guys behind him talking about the loophole, which was that you joined the Merchant Navy and then signed Form T124X, and that got you onto a Royal Navy ship with the danger money without joining the Navy, and you could do that at 16. the world is now such a small place with the internet that he had a tattoo in his arm with a woman's name, and then she chucked him. So he got it turned into a peacock in India, and he told me the ships that he was on and the ceremony for crossing the line, where the Merchant Navy basically dunk you in water and put soap on you if you've never crossed the equator before. And we found the ship, I think it was HMS Canton, and sure enough, there was a sailor, one of the Merchant Navy, with a toy cutlass in one hand. And on the forearm, you could see the smudge of the tattoo that had been changed in India. So this was almost certainly Griff standing in, whether it was 1943, doing the ceremony for crossing the line. Small world. But T124X, as I say, I was going to put that in the back of my neck, partly so that people would ask me what it was for, and then I could tell them the story of the Merchant Navy. Also, I thought if I get myself killed, it would make it easier to identify the body. So there might be a practical advantage. But generally, I think, and a lot of people my age think, that tattoos are pretty naff. And there are a lot of reasons for thinking that. There's a YouTube channel I quite like, Blue Collar Logic, and quite a thoughtful guy hosts it. And he said, imagine you said to your niece that you would give her $1,600 to buy a suit of clothes, she'd be pretty pleased. So you give her the 1,600, and once she puts them on, you say, the deal is you have to wear them for the next 3 months, nothing else, just wear those clothes. And of course, at the end of 3 months, no matter what you'd bought, you'd be sick to the back teeth of it. And that, of course, is exactly what a tattoo is. You're wearing the same suit of clothes indefinitely. Alternatively, it's not a suit of clothes, it's something else. It's a public declaration. So either it is decorative, like a blouse or a skirt or a pair of trousers, or it's something not a blouse, not a skirt, not a pair of trousers. It serves some other function. And of course, that is the truth of it. It does serve some other function. I've got a friend who, having failed first engineering and then social sciences at Glasgow Uni, largely because he just wasn't interested, but he ended up in the parachute regiment and then in the Special Air Service. And he said something really interesting, having passed out the parachute regiment. He said it was the most marginal soldiers who were rushing downtown to get tattoos of bulldogs wearing parachute regiment berries and all the other stuff. The very best soldiers, the thoughtful ones, the ones that were going to end up with special forces, they weren't the ones getting tattoos. The people plastering themselves in tattoos were people who needed to say something publicly the whole time, because they weren't saying it in their actions. They needed to tell themselves and everybody else, like an empty vessel, constantly broadcasting its void to the world. And as I've probably said before on the subject, if you're a train driver, or so I heard or read, if you're a train driver and someone puts themselves in the line and kills themselves, one of the questions they ask you when they're screening you for psychological counselling is, have you had a tattoo in the last 6 months? And the reason is because they know that there's a very powerful correlation between tattoos and psychological upset and difficulty. They know that offenders with visible tattoos are much more likely to be problematic in prison and have much greater problems. So not only is it not a good sign looking at it as an outsider, if you're minded to do that kind of thing, you might want to ask yourself whether it's a great sign for you, whether it represents a perfectly benign direction of attention and something that you simply want in the same way that you might want any other thing, or whether in actual fact it's a wee signal from your body to yourself, if I can make that Cartesian distinction, that all might not be well and that you should have a wee think about how well your life is going and whether you're prepared to make the kind of fundamental changes that the kind of Jordan Peterson tidy your room changes that would be an alternative to the tattoo. Because a person who, you know, spends 1,000 hours in a martial arts gym or a boxing gym learning how to inflict great damage on someone else might not be about a project that you admire, but there's something different there to putting a threatening tattoo across your face with a view to intimidating people. Because the capacity to actually unleash hell is a very different thing from taking £300 and an afternoon to declare to everybody that you can unleash hell when you can't. It's the difference between the diploma that the Scarecrow, I think, gets at the end of The Wizard of Oz and actually spending 4 years at university. There's a brilliant bit in Alan Sillitoe's Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, when the Borstal kid, I don't want to spoil it for you, so if you skip forward if you want to read the book, the Borstal kid who's let out every morning for cross-country running dominates the race on the day, and then to annoy the governor stops 15 feet short of the line and lets other people pass first so the governor doesn't get the win that he so values. There's a difference between, you know, spending 4 years and being absolutely brilliant at university and then refusing to take the final exam because you regard these things as naff, you regard labels as naff, and you want to be seen for your abilities. I'm not suggesting that you should do that, of course. Take the degree if you've earned it. But there's a kind of nobility in being concerned with fundamentals rather than paint and labels. Many years ago, when I was in the Officers Training Corps, funnily enough, with the guy who then joined the Army and the Special Forces, we were on this patrol competition. called the Cambrian Marches, and I carried a machine gun and the rucksack around Wales, and got terrible cramp, as many others did, and in my view we gave up in the middle of the night. At 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, there was a kind of furious discussion between the people in charge, and they all agreed that they couldn't continue, and they all laid down in the ground and in sleeping bags and ponchos, and I was vehemently against it. I wanted to troop on, but there was nothing I could do. And so we arrived too late for the final thing, which was a battle march, 8 miles, charging along the roads with all your kit that you have to complete in 2 hours. And we arrived too late, so they wouldn't allow us to complete that. Despite, I can still remember the officer. Should I name him? I'll make it easy for you to find him. He's an Employment Appeal Tribunal judge in Scotland now. But he argued to allow us to continue. He wanted to do it. And I didn't say it, but I felt like saying, well, at 4 o'clock this morning, we had the opportunity to continue, and we jacked, we bottled it. We wouldn't continue. The blisters were too bad, the cramp was too bad, the thirst was too bad, the exhaustion was too bad, and we sacked it. And but anyway, we got a certificate at the end, and I always went to the TA, I always went to the Officers Training Corps, I always pressed my uniform, I always went in. And there was to be an award ceremony for this Cambrian Marches, and everybody was to march up and salute proudly as the commanding officer gave them a certificate from the Cambrian Marches. And I deliberately didn't go in. It was 1985, and I deliberately didn't go in. I said to my pal, who was later on to become the Special Forces soldier, I said, the reason I didn't go in was because we jacked. I'm not taking a certificate for jacking. I'm not going to stand there and pretend that what happened at 4 o'clock in the morning didn't happen. And he said, in 1985, many years before he joined the regular army, I respect that. And he, like me, doesn't have any tattoos.